Group meeting, Friday, 16th April, 1982. I thought it might be useful to reconsider one or two points in connection with the silence as such. It is a silence not only of audible speech, but it is a silence of the inaudible speech which goes on in our own brain all the time. It's ceaseless, actually. It doesn't cease even in sleep, in our dream sleep. That chatter is going on. But it's only when we have deep, dreamless slumber that chatter ceases, you see. And it is during those hours that the whole psychophysical organism gets regenerated, particularly the physical organism. The dreamless slumber period is the one which regenerates the whole body, and so forth. And we considered certain points in connection with the significance of the silence of discursive thought. The flow of discursive thought stops altogether. Now, all thought in our ordinary everyday life and way is in terms of words. It's just a continuous flow of words all the time. And we saw that the significance of the word is that it limits consciousness to the realm of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. All words stand for objects, persons, events, situations, actions, then ideas, and so on. But they are all connected with the manifested world and represent that which belongs to the realm of birth, procedure, and death, you see. And we saw considered what happens when this flow of discursive thought stops. That, and the Buddha mentions this specifically, but I don't think that the verbal formulation as it stands in the conventional teachings of Buddhism conveys the tremendous importance of this stoppage. It just mentions it in passing, so to say, in the second, what they call the second jhana. In the first jhana, you have vitakka and vichara, which means applied thought and discursive thought, considering the thing. Well, when you consider anything, you're talking in your mind. And there comes the stage when this quietens down, this talk ceases. You are conscious more intensely and more sensitively as and when you approach this stage, and your sensitivity is at its highest when the discursive thought process has stopped. One mustn't think that one has become unconscious or gone to sleep. You haven't gone to sleep or become unconscious, provided it happens in the actual meditative process, you see. That is the point to remember. So now, when this discursive thought, when the stream of words stops, it means that being conscious in terms of mortality, of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal has ceased. You see, if you are fully awake, you are fully awake and intensely attentive, and your consciousness, which has functioned in the sphere of mortality, is freed of that sphere, then in what manner are you conscious? See, this is the important point. In what manner are you conscious? The mode of consciousness, the mode of mortality, which is the ordinary mode of our consciousness, gives place to the mode of immortality. Because with the cessation of all words, nothing representing beginning and ending, birth and death, things and separateness and all the rest of it is completely out. Then you experience this oneness, this unity in full awakened consciousness for the first time. You see? And this, of course, is a state of ecstasy, of rapture. Let me just read from early Indian religious thought. It's on page 321. All ordinary consciousness is limited to the sphere of sensation, emotion, and speech thought. In samadhi, there is the conscious transcendence of this sphere, the sphere of uprising and passing away, of birth and death, of samsara. In samadhi, in this state when discursive thought ceases, man enters the realm of the immortal, of that which eternally is. Mystics have talked of this as the void and also the plenum, the fullness. Here the mystics see the light of lights, hear the voice of the silence, touch God, know Brahman, enjoy bliss and experience the peace of God which passes understanding. You see, although this chapter deals with the Buddhist presentation, I am introducing the same ideas from the other religions also. That's why I've used the word God there and so forth. Well, now, actually you don't see any light or anything. See, in our sense of the word, see. Nor in a mental sense of conceiving of light. But that is just imagination. That is not the actuality. You hear nothing at all. All the senses are in a quiescent condition, completely quiescent. But consciousness itself is fully awake and fully sensitive in a manner which is entirely indescribable. It's an experience which is a non-descript experience. You see? And hence, because of this, it is the great teachers, the yogis, the mystics, have absolutely affirmed the reality of transcendence, no doubting at all. And those who have experienced that sort of thing, they never argue with anybody whether God exists or not and all the rest of it. It's useless arguing. You can use any word you like. You can turn God upside down and say dog, you see, and never mind the sound. The sound is merely a symbol. It's a symbol to represent a reality. The reality is something which you actually experience. So you see, the transformation, or transmutation in fact, of your mode of awareness of existence has changed from the mode of mortality into the mode of immortality. Because when you are in that state, nothing begins, proceeds, and finishes. Nothing at all. It is, nor is it a static condition. This is important to bear in mind. It is not a static condition. It is a dynamic state, an active state. It is a vibrant, thrilling state, you see. But it is not thrilling in the sense of sensation. There's no sensation about it. It is utterly peaceful. And there you experience the reality of peace which no ordinary mortal ever experiences. You see, that is why phrases like the peace of God which passes understanding have been used. In the Upanishadic and Hindu teachings and in the yogic teachings, they call this the realizing of the Atma. One unfortunate word has time and again crept in the Upanishads in this connection. They said, you realize your Atma. Now that is a mistaken phrase. There is no such thing as your Atma. The Atma is universal, absolutely universal. Can you take a carving knife and slice a little bit of it out for yourself and say, this is my Atma? You can't do it. It's totally impossible, you see. Now, consciousness is actually of that nature. Absolute consciousness are two English words which we can use to represent the Atma as such. Which means that absolute or pure consciousness, absolutely pure consciousness, is identical with the primordial creative energy. You see? Which, of course, as far as concepts and words are concerned, is nondescript. We can't describe it. But it is there. So this transformation of your mode of awareness has taken place. And then it is not merely you who are conscious in universal terms, but it is the universal consciousness which is able to manifest through your psychophysical organism. Now, you know, I've been talking about this since 1952, but I find again and again that people just can't get it somehow. Let the mind be quiet. Let the brain be quiet. And brain is the concretest part of mind. Mind itself is universal. Now, let the brain be quiet. If the brain can be quiet, and bodily quietness, this you can practice at home, you see. Bodily quietness is very helpful for the brain to become quiet. And just watch the process of quietening of the brain. The flow of thoughts, feelings, this thing, that thing, all that disappears. All your visual images, your oral, the oral contents in your consciousness, tunes, music, conversation, all that just quietens down. The sense of smell, the sense of taste, the sense of touch, everything completely quietens down, you see. And do remember, you're not going to sleep. Because if you go to sleep, you'll be unconscious. And in actual fact, when you do go into the real dreamless slumber state, and this great regeneration of the body takes place, consciousness is functioning at its own level, but it is not capable of coming through when you are awake. So you can never know what happened in the dreamless slumber state. After all, our psychologists and psychiatrists and so forth, they will analyze dreams. They can't analyze your dreamless slumber because there is nothing to report to them. But that is the really profoundly wide awake state. And it doesn't occur in sleep. It occurs only when the body is awake and under your complete control. You get the idea? You see? All right. So then, this is the experience of that which is the very first experience of death in the right way, in the right sense. One dies to the mortal and rises to the immortal. Do you know, in fact, St. Paul has written things along these lines in his epistle to the Corinthians and so forth, you see, when he talks about the resurrection and tries to explain the resurrection and so forth. But his terminology isn't sufficiently complete. But it is there. The great Christian mystics, particularly of the 12th and 13th and up to the 15th century, they did write wonderfully well about it all. Particularly men like Eckhart and Tauler, Ruysbroeck, and St. Teresa, they wrote very well about it. But they had to be so careful what they wrote because the church would come down upon them. And yet, Ruysbroeck was able to write quite openly, and he was never persecuted or challenged about it. He said, without any intermediary, which meant, of course, without Jesus Christ, because the Catholic Church, of course, grants these things, but it is only through the mediation of Jesus Christ. Well, now, that is not so, you see. So it's a marvel that Ruysbroeck was never persecuted for writing so openly. And then again, Eckhart too wrote openly certain things which in the ordinary way would have brought down persecution upon his head. When he said, "For man verily is God, God verily is man." I mean, absolutely outright he speaks like that, you see. And in that same collation, he talks about the Godhead, Gottheit, and says that is something which you can never talk about. It is universal. But God is actually the projection out of the mind of man of what he considers is the ultimate reality. It's man's brain which has projected God, the being. Man's brain cannot approach even Godhead, Gottheit, can't approach it. You see? But this is the first death, this stopping of the flow of discursive thought. Now, when I say stopping, don't think that you can deliberately stop it by an act of will. You have to let it happen. It just subsides. You know, just, I think last time I said, just as a storm outside, you just sit quietly in the house, in due time that storm will come to an end. It will completely subside, you see. That's the kind of thing, the nature of the process which goes on in your consciousness. There is this absolute calming down. Not so much goes on in your consciousness, but in your sense activities and in the brain. the memories and whatever there is, you see. All the disturbing factors are out, and you have died to the world of mortality. And you resurrect into the world of the sphere of immortality. Now this is the only immortality that there really is. This is the first stage. There are several such stages. Now do not think of the stages as in terms of a movement of mind or consciousness or anything at all. There is no movement as such. Movement is not the right word in this context. What happens is that there is an intensification of consciousness, you see. This intensification of consciousness takes place, and you experience profounder reality all the way through. At the fourth jhana, there comes another death like that, you see. When all sense impressions completely go down altogether, and you are conscious in terms of the infinity of akasha, and then the infinity of vijnana. Now, these two relate to existential manifestation, akasha, and to consciousness, to discriminative consciousness. Now the infinity of discriminative consciousness simply means the pure absolute consciousness, you see. It's universal. There is no my consciousness or your consciousness involved in it. It is just consciousness functioning through a living human organism as such. And so there is a second death there. And there is a third death which takes place finally, as far as man is concerned, because we are in the ultimate limited by our constitution. You see, neither a Christ or a Buddha or anybody can go beyond that, whatever one does, because there is the fundamental limitation imposed by the fact that we exist as an animal organism, you see. And that in that third death, what I call in the heart of religion, the passage through the third portal, there all your perceptions and feelings have ceased. Now, perception and feeling in that context, at that level, does not mean and has no relationship to what we understand by perception and feeling. When you enter into that state of the infinity of akasha and vijnana, you are one with the infinite. That man, R.W. Trine, wrote a book called In Tune with the Infinite. In Tune with the Infinite, you see. Now, the reality of that being in tune with the infinite is this at-homeness of consciousness in the infinity of existence and of discriminative consciousness. Consciousness is very much related to time. You see? So you transcend time altogether there, in that state, completely beyond time. Having realized that state, then there comes the state of which can only be described as perception and feeling. And in Buddhist terminology, you have, I think, a very, very good presentation. There is that fourth samapatti, And samapatti, in the dictionary says, means attainment, achievement. I think that's an unfortunate translation. It's much better to regard it as a coalescence. The separate self has completely lost its separateness and it is one with this ocean of existence at a transcendent level. And there you have this transcendent perception and transcendent feeling. There are no words in any language that I know of anyway, and I have not come across any writings which can sort of suggest what is the real meaning of perception and feeling at that level. So all the writings have left the words perception and feeling. That completely ceases, you see. And then there is the total unity with infinity, eternity and immortality. You see? Now I wouldn't be at all surprised if Eckhart had experienced this, which made him write, "Man verily is God, God verily is man." It is this kind of experience which made all the great spiritual teachers and founders of religion in the past postulate God, you see, and postulate the omnipotence, the omniscience, and the omnipresence of God. So that is the third death. You are now completely liberated from any and everything that binds, that limits as such. But the limitation, the freedom from that limitation does not mean that a subject, a particular person, I, John Smith or whoever it may be, you see, am God. Not at all. And this is where I think that the Upanishadic phrase, "Aham Brahmasmi," is not a very felicitous phrase, because its literal translation is, "I am Brahman." You see? Now the moment one says or writes, "I am," the "I" always refers to this particular individual who is talking or writing. You see, you can't get away from that. So it gives it tends to misguide. But of course in those days what could they do but write that sort of thing? There was no option in the matter. And we must give all credit to the Upanishads for having made the profoundest statements about transcendence. And they succeeded more than anybody else in doing that. Especially when they completely identified Atma and Brahman as such. That Atma-Brahman identity, positively affirmed as they did, was something stupendous, really. It was an extraordinary thing that human beings could have said that. So, you see, that is the ultimate silence. It is the silence which is the realization of immortality. And immortality is manifest through universal consciousness, function through a finite being. Now you see, consider in this connection, I think Richard Wagner must have had some sort of peculiar inspired insight when he wrote Parsifal. If you look through Parsifal, all the words carefully, you will find in that opera Gurnamans, for instance, saying, "Here space has become one with time." Well, that anticipated Einstein's space-time continuum. But Einstein's space-time continuum is related to this world of the mortal, of the material world, you see. But Gurnemans was talking of an immortal world. And that space-time identity is fully experienced in the fourth and fifth, in the first and second samapatis, the fourth and fifth stages going up from the jhanas, you see. Is this, are you able to follow this or is it confusing? Is it all right? So now, as you know, Parsifal recovers that spear and he heals the wound of Amfortas, and Kundry is also completely healed and she falls lifeless down to the ground. He was an extraordinary dramatist. The great spiritual realities which he perceived, and yet his personal life was such a terrible life. That's one of the extraordinary things. It's a little bit like the poet Dante. He wrote marvelous poetry. He was the greatest mystical poet Europe produced. But his personal life was very reprehensible in so many respects. I've got a book which has the lives of all these people, and I was absolutely amazed that the man who could have written Inferno Purgatorio and Paradiso, that extraordinary poem, you see, could in his personal life have been like that, and yet that sort of poetry came through, you see. However, it expresses a reality which the religia can bring into being in actual everyday life. And once one goes through that, one has really transcended death. What is the phrase? O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy
victory?
Yes, that's it. My memory is really dissolving away very rapidly now. I mean, the phrases like that, I never make a mistake in the old days. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? This is the realization, you see. So one sees that if one wants to live the religious life, the practice of quietness, of stillness and of silence is of the utmost importance. In fact, I believe that it is perhaps the most important thing, really, this stillness and silence. Because after all, when we consider these things carefully, we will see that we are noisemakers in the world. We are so self-intrusive, self-obtrusive upon the world, with all our ambitions and self-conceits and our ideas and our behavior and all the rest of it, all our mental defilements, our greeds and violence and fear and vanity and egoism and all the rest of it, and so forth, you see. We are awful, it makes an awful noise, a real cacophony. Otherwise, there would be the music of the spheres in the real sense. It's rather amusing when modern science was able to record the sort of sound that comes out of the galaxies and so on. It was a sort of a just a little unmusical noise. And they were a little bit sarcastic about those great sages who talked of the music of the spheres, you see. But the scientists have to yet to get beyond this realm of the finite, the temporal and the mortal before they are able to record that which is a music. And one has to bear in mind that the transcendent world is the sort of non-transcendent world upside down. You know the great hermetic maxim, as above, so below. You see? But the as above, so below is rather like this. You know what a cone is, a cone. All right. Now take two cones and balance them on their points, or put them in a, support them in a position where they're like that, you see. Now you've got the real sense of the as above, so below. Otherwise, what thinkers, philosophers, intellectuals have done is to project that which is here to the transcendent, which is the wrong way around. You see? So that it's more like a mirror image. When you look at yourself in the mirror, your right hand is the left hand of the mirror, of the image, and your left hand is the right hand, is the right hand of the image, isn't it? It's like that. Not in the way that people have sort of projected themselves and the mortal and the finite into the transcendent realm. This is where the brilliance of the brain can often be a great hindrance. It prevents you from really seeing what is the truth of the matter. Now, people sometimes say, now that's all very nice, but what? How does it affect mankind? What good does it do? We have all our problems and so on and so on, and if you just go off into a state of immortality inside yourself, it's no use to us. People don't know. If we, each of us, who functions in terms of discriminative consciousness, brings about this transformation of our mode of awareness of existence, that transformation into the universal consciousness is a tremendous energy, an energy which of course cannot be measured scientifically or recorded in material instruments and so forth. It is a tremendous energy which affects the discriminative consciousness of all human beings on the earth without their knowing it. You see? And people may feel a little bit sarcastic and say, oh yes, we see the world getting worse and worse. What are all your gurus and sages and holy men doing? You see? They can't do anything about it. But we don't know really what happens. The process of destruction has its place in the growth of man and in the process of his fruition. it's a little bit like this. Supposing you buy an old house which is in a very dilapidated condition. What do? It is broken down, and then the new house is built, you see. And the new house will, of course, be a proper house to live in and stay. It's something like that. This breakdown of what is actually present is necessary sometimes. People don't wake up to reality, to truth, to goodness, to beauty, and so forth, unless they are hit hard on the head. And so we have to understand that all of it has its place. And the transmutative process involves destruction of that which was the previous condition. So now, yes, I think I've said everything. And of course, the golden way is the mindfulness. The constant mindfulness. Really, constant mindfulness is the whole of the religious life. Otherwise, there is no religious life. Constant mindfulness. Just watch, and watch without criticism, without wishing this, that, or the other were different. This is how it is. Yes, this is how it is. And if you really see and become fully conscious that this is how it is, then the change can take place in the whole psychophysical organism. But if you can't get intensely conscious, have that real flame of consciousness, you see, it won't happen. So that flame of consciousness was represented in the Rig Veda by the god Agni, the Lord of Fire. But Agni means not only fire, but also light, Tejas. And in connection with consciousness, the word Tejas is used, which means both heat and light. You have to hot up, and it will give out the light, you see, and so forth. So, quietness, silence, is of the utmost importance in the religious life.